I'm here with David Fitton, who was British High Commissioner to Jamaica from 2013 until 2017. So David joined the FCO in 1980. Thank you for talking to us today. Could you tell me a little bit about your career in the FCO during the 1980s and up to present
sure.
day?
Sure. I joined in 1980, as you said, from university, and spent a year, I think a training year as it was in those days, working on African affairs. And then was chosen to, as many people were, to learn a hard language, in my case Japanese. So I spent a year at SOAS and then a year at our institute in Japan studying Japanese, and then spent time in the economic section in the embassy. So that was my first posting as second secretary. I went back to Japan two more times on postings, most recently the one before Jamaica. And in between, I was in various places such as India and Turkey, and obviously stints in the Foreign Office in London doing various jobs, crisis management, various geographical jobs, all sorts of things, the usual sort of variety. Preparing, I suppose, to become a head of mission, which I was when I went to Jamaica, where I was responsible for UK-Jamaica affairs and UK-Bahamas as well.
And what were the priorities of the UK government at that time, about 2013?
Vis-a-vis Jamaica?
Yeah.
I think probably our main priority was to help Jamaica get a grip on its security situation. In all sorts of forms, we had quite a large High Commission, I was surprised to find when I got out there.
How large?
I'm trying to remember, my memory's not great, but I think probably about 60 to 70 UK-based staff, which was on a par with a huge mission like Tokyo, and that surprised me a bit. Not all of them were Foreign Office staff, they were from various departments. An obvious example is DFID, who were still in existence in those days. And they were there. There were people from the Home Office doing visa work and so on. People from some of the police agencies, the NCA, for example, were there helping with their Jamaican colleagues, as I say, to help promote a better security situation in the country, which had been quite bad in the years before I got there, and still was in certain areas. There were states of emergency from time to time. And we helped train police officers, we helped work with civil society, funding through DFID and so on. So it was quite a varied activity. The thing that was struck me anyway as being less the case than when I was in Tokyo immediately before was our trade and investment effort, which was quite large in a post like Tokyo, and less so in a post like Kingston, Jamaica.
And how did those two contexts compare then? I know we're talking about very different...
Very, very different. I mean, I was number two in a large mission in Japan, and a lot of our work there was working with the Japanese, increasingly on things like security and defence, but not as much as these days, but particularly on trade and investment into the UK, trade in both directions. A large area of work was developing on the science side, developing science links and commercial links in life sciences and so on. There wasn't much of that in Jamaica. There were small company-to-company links which we tried to promote, and during the 4 years I was there, there were a number of companies came through who were interested in working with Jamaican partners. And there were some Jamaican companies who looked to us for help here in the UK. So that was quite rewarding when it came to fruition, but it was much smaller, much, much smaller.
Mm. What can you name any specific companies?
Well, a lot of Jamaican food and drinks companies who sell their products here in the UK and don't always particularly need the British government's help, but occasionally they were looking for partners to work with, so there was that. In the other direction, I remember there was an oil exploration company who came out and looked at the possibility of exploring for oil and gas in the seas around Jamaica.
And how did that go?
By the time I left, it hadn't produced any results. But these are very long-term, often long-term plans. And it's always surprised me how much energy, finance, and so on, they devoted to something which might come to nothing. I can't honestly tell you how it's turned out, so I just don't know. But they remained pretty confident during the time I was there.
What kind of projects were DFID involved in? Can you remember any specific?
Yeah, there were all sorts, but it was not the DFID I'd been used to, for example, in India when I was posted there, or working with DFID in the UK and their activities elsewhere around the world in Africa and so on. It was more to do with civil society, helping promote security. They funded some of the work in training the security forces, for example, the army, the police, and so on, in better able to protect the Jamaican society and do it in a way which didn't impinge on people's human rights and so on, things like that. So a lot of their funding went into that. I remember, probably one of my most frequent contacts was with the Ministry of National Security and with the Ministry of Justice, working on behalf of DFID primarily.
And then which civil society organisations in Jamaica?
Asking. I can't remember the names, but a number of NGOs. I can picture some of the people we worked with, but I honestly can't remember the names of them. Some of them are very well known, and if they come back to me, I'll certainly let you know.
So you mentioned that the High Commission was significantly larger than you had expected before you arrived. And in relation to the other High Commissioners that we've been speaking to as part of this project, Jamaica really is the biggest. What do you think has contributed to the such an input of resources and energy, basically?
You're right. It's certainly in terms of our Caribbean posts, it was the biggest. I think the one in Bridgetown is a little bit, it probably is not too far off, but it wasn't quite as big and as active. I think primarily in the time I was there, it was the security support, whether it was through DFID or through direct support, police to police and so on. It took varied forms, but I think that occupied a lot of our efforts. We had, just as I arrived in 2013, we'd had experts out there conducting a review of their prisons service. So for the first time in my life, I visited and went into a prison in Jamaica. And then after that, numerous times.
And was that a consultant, as I understand? Was he based at different places in the Caribbean?
He may well have been, but he did a review of the prison service in Jamaica. And that, I think, formed a basis for a lot of the financial and technical support which we provided. Again, some of it through DFID. And some of it through the Ministry of Justice.
And so tell me about your prison experience.
The most bizarre experience, I went numerous times to the prison in downtown Kingston, which is, as you can imagine, is not a very pleasant place. But we'd worked with them before I arrived as High Commissioner, and I carried on doing that. And the most bizarre experience was going there for a cricket match. Part of our support was working with an NGO run by very famous Jamaican fast bowler, and I'm embarrassed to say his name is Courtney. I'm sorry, I can't remember his surname. Anyway, famous fast bowler, and we did a lot of work with an organisation which he ran, which was to help disadvantaged elements of society through cricket to become more constructive members of society, and he part of this was to work with prisoners. So we went in one time with him, and he organised a cricket match in the prison, slightly smaller than a full-size cricket ground, and no one was quite sure who would go looking for the ball if they hit it over the wall. But it was a bizarre experience, but it showed the value of helping. Courtney Walsh was the name of the prisoner, the name of the cricketer. And it showed the benefit of using innovative methods to try and help the disadvantaged people in society, and that was a very good example. So we did that. The head of the prison service in Jamaica, who worked under the Minister of National Security at the time, it was a woman at first when I was there, and she organised a number of activities which came out of some of the support I think we provided. So we provided technical support and help for prisoners to develop skills while they were in prison. I think some of that was funded by DFID as well. And So she organised an exhibition of prisoners' work, whether it was paintings or baking or whatever it was, some of the stuff they'd learnt through being supported by outside organisations such as us. And so I was invited along to one of their open days. Again, very strange. It was like a school fete, but in a prison, put on by prisoners who were demonstrating the skills they'd learned. So little things like that.
And while you were in prison, did you meet anybody who had lived in the UK or who had maybe been returned to Jamaica?
Not then, there were other times that I did. I was going to mention, and we can come on to this if you like later, but one of the activities that the High Commissioner was involved in was returning prisoners who were in prison here who were of Jamaican nationality. That itself, as you must appreciate, over the years has become quite a sensitive issue, mm-hmm. not just with Jamaica but with other countries too. And we worked, again funded through our Ministry of Justice and DFID, helping an NGO called, I think one of them was called Open Arms, and there was another one we worked very closely with, and they were organisations who helped returnees to reintegrate themselves back into Jamaica life. So I remember going to visit one of them, I'm not sure whether it was Open Arms or another one, and it was basically in a little rundown villa which had been converted into a sort of dormitory and run by a guy who's sadly now passed away. And some of the returnees or people he was looking after were there in the house while we were there, so we met them. So a couple of them had come from the UK, I think.
So talk to me a little bit more then about those kind of initiatives that you're involved in. Particularly, I'm interested in people who had maybe lived in the UK and then been incarcerated and then were at some point deported. What interactions did you as High Commissioner have, and also was anybody working at the High Commission that specifically dedicated to that role?
We had a team, a smallish team, I think about three or four people who were dedicated to that role. Not just that role, but that was part of the work they did. They were Home Office staff or locally engaged Jamaican colleagues. And so, you know, their contact with, primarily with the NGOs who supported these people coming back.
And what kind of support did they?
Well, as I say, they provided accommodation, like dormitory accommodation, or helped them to find contacts in the local community, perhaps for jobs and so on, once they came back. Because these were people who were brought back in, and we worked very closely with the Ministry of National Security and the Ministry of Justice, but they were taken off a plane and in theory had nowhere to go. You know, they may not have lived in Jamaica for quite some time, some of them. And so our work with these NGOs was to try and help them through those NGOs find a sort of trusting environment when they came back. We helped one specific way we helped was to produce a video at the time. So there were lots of posters and leaflets and so on, but often it was easier just to produce a video. I can't remember whether it was online or whether it was a DVD. I think it might have been a DVD. So, you know, it would show a little bit of what was to come to these people before they arrived back, and then what sort of help was available when they got back to Jamaica.
Was there any kind of psychological or psychiatric support available?
Not that we provided. We weren't specialists in that area, but through the NGOs it might well have been available. Some of the NGOs that I visited, I mentioned one, but there were a couple around Kingston, and there was one in Montego Bay I went to as well. I wouldn't call them psychiatric support, but they provided more than just practical support. They provided a sort of friendship. The people I visited, I can think of one particular chap in Montego Bay who ran an organisation there, whose name, again, I can't remember, but he was, you know, he was committed to this. He spent his whole life there. Goodness knows what his family thought of the time he spent with them, because, you know, he seemed to be totally committed, he and his staff, to helping these people.
Okay. And you mentioned as well there were Home Office staff that were based at the High Commission. What was their role?
Well, there were people who worked in a relatively large visa section, for example. So issuing visas, whether it be for study or for visit visas or for work, various forms. You know, there were often people who were doing business with the UK who needed to have visas to come here. People and studying likewise.
Just to clarify for our listeners then, Jamaicans need a visitor visa to enter the UK.
I think it's still the case that they do, yes.
Whereas some of their Caribbean counterparts do not need.
Yeah.
Okay. So that meant that created quite a lot of bureaucratic work then at the High Commission.
Yeah. They, as happens with the visa service worldwide, some of that was outsourced.
Where was that
outsourced? There's an organisation, and it differs in different countries, but they had a visa centre in Kingston. It wasn't that far from the High Commission, but people who had to go in for interviews for those sorts of visas had to go to that place rather than come to the High Commission. Then the paperwork was transferred to the High Commission to be...
And the interviews that took place in the visa centres were carried out by third parties, is that correct?
Yes, and the initial visa applications.
And what kind of questions would they ask people?
They would ask for details of finances, what was the purpose of the visit, and so on. I guess the background to all of this is that, you know, in the past there have been people who've given one reason for going to the UK, and it turns out their reason for going has not been that reason. They've ended up overstaying their visa validity. So they, you know, it's as when issuing visas anywhere, it's a case of trying to understand why people are going and whether they are entitled to a visa.
And what kind of technologies were available at that time? Because I know that from about 2010, the British government began introducing online application systems already, maybe even before. I just wondered when that was introduced in Jamaica.
I can't honestly remember. I'm not sure. I mean, some of them were... It was possible to do a certain amount online, but if you had to provide fingerprints, you know, to match your passport and so on, then you would have to come in to do that.
Mm. Did you have a lot of British citizens, for example, who were based in Jamaica?
Not a huge number. We had a consular section who look after Brits overseas, as they do in any embassy or consulate, and we had a number of honorary consuls. These were people who are paid a small amount a year, not a salary, but just a one-off payment a year. And then if any problem arises in a remote part of the country, they are the first point of contact for Brits, you know, people with British passports who are in trouble, might have lost their passport, for example. So we had that, plus a consular team, a permanent consular team based in the High Commission in Kingston, who would help people who, you know, had problems, whatever it might be, if they were in trouble with the law, or they might have lost their passport. As I say, passports weren't issued by the High Commission, they were issued by the Passport Office. During the time I was there...
The Passport Office in
the UK.
In the UK.
So during the time I was there, I think initially when I was there, and this was certainly the case before I was in Jamaica, people would apply for their passport via the embassy or High Commission, and it would be sent off, and in some cases it might even be issued in that country. But during the time I was there, it was all moved back to the UK.
So the passport processing service then, the passport was printed in the UK.
Exactly.
And then physically posted back to...
Yeah, either back to the High Commission or embassy in the country concerned, or to the individual in some cases.
Did that cause any issues? Or?
It was, people weren't used to it, and they were often used to, you know, the old days, let's say, where they would come into an embassy, apply for a new passport, hand over their paperwork, have an interview, and then maybe a few days later or a few weeks later would be given a passport.
Mm. So how long would that process take?
It would sometimes take quite a while because of the need to get the thing back, you know, to post the thing back to the UK. In a country like Jamaica, probably about a couple of months at least, I think, to get a passport.
So I'm just imagining a British tourist, for example, who loses their passport.
Well, in that case, there are emergency travel documents, and a consular section can issue those.
Okay. What was your relationship like with other West Indian diplomats? Did you meet regularly with other diplomats stationed in Kingston?
Yeah.
So what kind of meetings did you have? What kind of discussions?
There were frequent opportunities. There were social and work related opportunities, but to be honest, there weren't that many other Caribbean country diplomats in Jamaica.
Mm.
I'm desperately trying to think who was there now. There was a Trinidad High Commission. I don't think there was a Barbados one in Jamaica. They probably, you know, were close enough not to need to do that. There was one other. There was an honorary diplomat from one of the other Caribbean countries there. But the number of missions was quite small anyway. There were very few European missions there, about four or five from the EU, the Americans, the Canadians, Mexican, sort of some South American ones, Russian, Chinese, Japanese. That was more or less it. So, you know, the social gatherings or the work gatherings which involved overseas diplomats, whether it was briefing meetings and so on, most would go. So those would be the opportunities to catch up with other diplomats if you weren't doing it one-to-one.
And when you had your discussions on securitization and looking at the region in particular, who was sat at the table? For example, did you have a lot of engagement with US diplomats or Canadian diplomats?
Mm. It varied. We did a lot bilaterally with the Jamaicans, but we worked also very closely with the US and Canada in particular, as you mentioned. And we did some tripart and bipart projects with some of those countries. We also worked with the EU Commission delegation who were based there on some security and civil society type projects. But it was primarily with the Americans and the Canadians, I think, or ourselves alone.
I'm also quite interested in the reparations debate because I know that began to kind of pick up momentum.
Yes.
Around the time that you were in Jamaica,
yeah.
Did you were you aware of any either protests or I was reading a Vereen Shepherd article recently, and your name was mentioned as well, which was quite interesting. I just wondered if that was something that was a priority or on the radar.
It was very much on the radar, although I wouldn't say it was, you know, the top issue all the time. But occasionally I was invited to events, particularly at the university, where people like Vereen Shepherd and the, the Vice-Chancellor, whose name you will probably know better than me, who, you know, they would arrange...
Hilary Beckles.
That's right, Hilary Beckles. Or we would appear together on a TV programme with interviews and so on.
Oh, great. What kind of media coverage was that?
Well, it may not have been specifically about reparations. Mm-hmm. It may have been about a visit or something like that, which sparked off, you know, a UK minister visiting might spark off a debate about reparations from certain quarters, and occasionally I'd be invited along. It wasn't always comfortable, you know, it was a subject which had to be faced and had to be discussed at times. But I don't remember any particular protests, demonstrations or things like that. But certainly at the university there were people who felt very strongly about it, mm. You know, with every justification, and wanted to air their views.
Mm. I know that in 2013 the CARICOM crime and security strategy came out. Did you have any involvement with, or what was your involvement with CARICOM?
It was, I think that may have come out of, followed out of a CARICOM summit, which took place just before I went out to Jamaica, but which I did attend in, you know, as part of my pre-posting briefing here in London. And there was at least one other CARICOM meeting while I was there. I wasn't particularly involved in the formation of that strategy, but it reflected a lot of what we were already trying to do with countries like Jamaica, and to a lesser extent in those days with some of the other CARICOM countries. But I think the activity in countries like Trinidad and Tobago was probably increased since I left. And it reflected a bit of what we're doing and also influenced a bit of what we were doing, if I could look at it that way.
Okay. So how important were the issues of migration, citizenship, and also forcible return in the diplomatic relations that you were having?
They were fairly prominent. I mean, as I said earlier, a lot of my contacts were with the National Security Ministry and the Ministry of Justice, and those were issues that were, you know, uppermost in their minds as well.
What were their specific concerns?
Well, they were concerned, to give an example, I mentioned earlier, about the state of their prisons and how they could be better run and so on.
Was there a feeling that Jamaica was having to deal with basically a lot of pressure due to prison population size?
There was the main prison in Kingston was probably, you know, if I'm honest, not really fit for purpose. It was an old prison from the 19th century originally, which had been, parts of it had been modernised, but not hugely. And we contributed some funding to help build bits of the prison. But it, and I think one of the things we specifically contributed to was a reception centre for families across the road for them from the prison. But, you know, they were always interested in trying to learn from our experience, and if we could help support them in any way, they were keen that we should. So all of those sort of issues were uppermost in the Jamaican government's mind as well as ours. We had a separate issue which we've touched on, which was the government was keen here in the UK to return prisoners to countries where they came from if they had been in prison for a certain amount of time and had committed certain offences.
Yeah, so what kind of crimes then would see a deportee basically face a long prison sentence in Jamaica?
It varied. Obviously violent crimes, sometimes murder and so on, rape, that sort of thing. It really did vary. We had a British prisoner, a British national who was in prison in Jamaica who'd committed murder in Jamaica. But there were Jamaicans too who'd, you know, committed violent crime here in the UK and who'd served a certain amount of their time here, and then the UK government was keen to deport them back.
And what about deportations as well? So maybe not severe criminal acts, but something that would be enough to get somebody deported from the UK?
I'm not aware of any of those during my time. Most of the deportations we dealt with were people coming from prison in the UK. Or there may have been some who'd overstayed their visas, so they were in detention centre. I guess that meets the requirement of what you've just mentioned. The majority of cases we dealt with were, I think, prisoners who were being deported back to Jamaica as they were to other countries. Not all successfully. Some of them challenged the deportation case and were successful in that challenge.
So you're in post from 2013 until 2017.
Yes.
And as you know, the Windrush scandal really hit front page, became front page news in April 2018. So I think that's a really interesting time period in terms of the time that you're in Jamaica and your involvement as well with all of these different processes that we've been talking about in terms of people acquiring their documents or people being British nationals being deported to Jamaica. I'm just interested. Did you pick up at all, or did any of your staff bring to you concerns regarding British nationals who either could not obtain their documentation or were having problems renewing their documents?
The terminology is interesting. You say British nationals. In the eyes of the Home Office, they might not have been British nationals. The phrase Windrush scandal had not come across my radar at all by the time I left Jamaica. But the issue, there were a couple of cases which had arisen during my last year there, which effectively were part of the Windrush problem. But I hadn't realised, I don't think any of us had at that stage, to what extent they were part of the problem.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think that it took such a long time for kind of the scale of the scandal to...
It's a very good question. I don't honestly know the answer, but I think part of the answer was that not enough cases had come to light. And you know, a number of us working on UK-Jamaican relations, whether it was the High Commissioner or people who were my staff, or people back in the UK, might not have been aware that this was a major issue. Perhaps, you know, they should have been, but they weren't. It came to my attention, you know, almost accidentally. The first case, I think, was somebody who was in Jamaica, I think a person from who lived in the UK since childhood, and had gone out to Jamaica. I may have got some of this story wrong, so please forgive me. But my memory is that he'd gone to Jamaica. He was about my age. He was in his late 50s at the time. And he'd gone to Jamaica possibly for a funeral, something like that. Anyway, for family reasons. And afterwards, he'd stayed on. And when he wanted to fly back, he had his return ticket. But when he got to the airport, he didn't have a visa to go into the UK. In his Jamaican
passport. Was he
it would have been on a Jamaican passport, okay. I'm guessing. And he didn't realise he needed a visa because he lived in the UK all his life, and he'd assumed that, you know, he would automatically be able to get back in. Mm. And somebody in the press picked it up, and I can't remember his name, and I wouldn't want to mention the name anyway. But what struck me was from this article in the press, this person had lived in the same town I'd lived in when I was at his age. We might even have been at school together, I don't know. Anyway, I saw this case and thought, this is very strange. Asked my visa staff, how could this have happened? And they came to the same conclusion based on logic that I did, that he must have had a Jamaican passport but had not had a visa to return because he didn't realise he needed one. And he was effectively stranded in Jamaica. My colleagues in the Home Office staff in the visa section, at my suggestion, got in touch with their Home Office colleagues in the UK and to see if they could work this out. And it wasn't straightforward. It should have been, but it wasn't straightforward. The people concerned, this will sound very familiar to you now that the story has become much bigger. People concerned in the UK wanted him to provide evidence of him having lived in the UK, whether it was a driving license, school attendance, and all sorts of things, which of course he wouldn't necessarily have taken with him to Jamaica. So it was quite a sad case. Now in his case, I think, if I remember rightly, he was fortunate in that he had family in Jamaica who he could stay with while all this was being sorted out. And eventually it was sorted out and he went back. And you're probably going to ask me how long it took, and I can't remember. But it was longer than it should have taken. It was weeks, months. Not long afterwards, there was another case, two sisters. But that didn't come up in the press. I think they asked to come in to the High Commission because they had a similar case. They couldn't get back. And I actually met them. They came into my office and sat down and had a cup of coffee, and we talked it through. And again, they had family in Jamaica. Obviously, they'd been to visit this family, but for some reason hadn't realised or hadn't been told that they needed to make sure that their passport was in order to get back.
So again, did they travel on Jamaican passports?
Yeah, of course, yeah. If they'd had a British passport, they wouldn't have had any problem at all.
So when did these changes come in? Do you know when the border controls started to tell people that they needed a visa?
Whenever visas were introduced, then this would have always been the case. And there may well have been cases like this before I was in Jamaica, you know, and there may have been cases while I was in Jamaica, but they just didn't come to light. The people may have sorted the problem out through their own contacts, or they may have had to wait, as these people did, and sorted it out and just not come to our attention. Mm. But these two particular cases came to my attention. I think the second one of the two sisters was quite not long before I left Jamaica. But that's why it's remained in my memory. It clearly wasn't right. Something was wrong. And one of the things that was wrong, and which the Jamaican government tried to help with, was that the Jamaican authorities in London, for example, when they were issuing passports, new passports, renewing passports, put a little slip in saying, don't forget if you travel, you might need a visa to come back to this country.
That sounds like that was a good idea.
Yeah, that was a good idea. But, people may not have realised it was necessary.
Mm. But that was the Jamaican authorities that were taking it upon them.
They were. I think, you know, I suspect partly at our suggestion to try and help not have to face this problem again. But the basic problem was that these people, these Jamaican people who found themselves in trouble, had been living in the UK, some of them perhaps born in the UK, but some of them certainly living in the UK since they were children, came across and were then part of the so-called Windrush generation. So they were British subjects at that time, but they never actually obtained a British passport.
What do you think stopped them from obtaining a British passport?
Well, it may have been that they just didn't see it was necessary. The status under which they came, a lot of this came out later in the press in the UK, the status under which they came, they were able to work, to go to school, to had access to healthcare, National Health Service, and all the rest of it, quite rightly. And I think, you know, it's no surprise now that the situation on immigration, nothing to do with Jamaica, but generally, became much tougher in the 2000s onwards. And
why was that? Why specifically?
Well, it clearly was a decision by the British government at the time, in the mid, I don't know when the date would be, around 2008,
2010. 2007, I think.
You know better than I do. Clearly a decision taken to be tougher on immigration. And so people who might have gone to Jamaica, let's say, to quote one country which I'm familiar with, would have gone and not had that difficulty coming back because they might have had a Jamaican passport, but they might have been able to prove that they lived in the UK.
Yeah, so there was more informality in the system.
I suspect so. I don't know for certain, but I suspect so.
And potentially that people, if they found they were challenged, for example, by somebody at passport control, could quite easily prove that they lived in the UK through various connections.
Mm. And it probably was more of an issue once they got back to the UK in those days, whereas in more recent years, from 2000s onward, the airlines became responsible for checking people. So the airlines were fined quite heavily if they allowed people to travel who didn't have the right to travel. So Mr. X, who found himself in Jamaica and wanted to board a plane, suddenly found he couldn't. So he's stranded in a country he doesn't know as well as he should. And in the old days, he might have got at least as far as the immigration desk at Heathrow or Gatwick and then been able to get his family to provide some information for him.
How did that policy come in with the airlines?
Well, I think it was seen as a way of helping to solve a problem of people travelling to the UK who didn't have the right to travel.
Was it just for UK airlines, though, or was this...
No, I think it applied to all airlines, I think, so, and not just Jamaica, by any means, in any country.
So effectively, then, immigration control was kind of being handed out to, or extended to, airline staff. And because the airlines faced really hefty charges of, fines, if they allowed people on their plane that were then returned, that led to a situation in Kingston, for example, where people couldn't even get on the plane.
I wouldn't say immigration was handed out to the airlines because, you know, the people applying for visas had to go through quite a detailed process. But the airlines were asked to check that they did have the correct documentation, visa, work visa, visit visa, or whatever it was. So in that sense, the airlines were given the job of becoming a first barrier at the airport. But the documents were checked when people arrived at the airport in the UK.
So were you aware of any campaigns, for example, you mentioned, which I thought was very interesting, the fact that the Jamaican High Commission in London put a slip of paper into people's passports, so to let their nationals know, basically, that they might encounter difficulties. Were you aware of any other campaigns that, or any NGOs or civil society organisations that got involved in informing people or communicating?
Not at that time, but I suspect, I'm almost sure it did begin to happen. Once this issue became more widespread and more and better known. But as I say, there were only a couple of cases that arose that came to my attention, and I'm pretty sure there weren't other cases that came to the attention of my staff that they didn't inform me about if they were serious like this. If there was a case that came to the attention of my staff and they were able to sort it out, resolve it, then they may not have told me. But that would have been solved particularly quickly. That I don't know what that might have been. There may have been some documentation, but it wasn't the correct documentation. But cases like those two I mentioned were obviously very serious and, you know, on a human level as anything else. So we wanted to do whatever we could to try and help. And I hope I'm right in saying that in the end we were able to help, but not just us, the combined efforts of the Jamaican authorities, us, and the Home Office back here. But there was, from, you say it was 2007, I wasn't sure of the date.
The hostile environment was from 2010.
From then, there was certainly a more hostile environment, which didn't help resolve this problem.
Yeah, so the hostile environment was introduced really in 2010, right. But from the mid-2000s there were measures that began having an impact on immigration control and these kind of things. Okay, that's really, really interesting. What about, I might have already asked you this, but I'm just coming back to this. What about Jamaican nationals in Kingston? Were there people who were eligible, for example, for a British passport that began either applying for their documents either for themselves or their children from Kingston, and what kind of impact did that have on the consular services really? And the kind of
there were. There was a section of the consular team which specialised in dealing with this. So these people would still have to apply for their passport for themselves or their relatives in the same way that a Brit would apply who was renewing his passport, let's say. But these British citizens might be, they might be dual citizens, they might have Jamaican or other nationality and want to make sure that their children had British nationality. So they would apply, and occasionally the people they applied to in the passport office would ask our team in the High Commission to interview these people to check that, you know, what they were saying was correct. And there were cases, I can't think of any off the top of my head now, but there were cases where people fraudulently applied for British passports in this way, and that was the reason that, you know, a specific officer was there to interview people and to.
Can you remember any specific examples of fraud? Or kind of the kind of.
I can remember one example, which I won't go into, where there was a lot of concern that it was a fraudulent case. It came to my attention too, it brought to my attention. And so, you know, it took a long time for the issuing of the passport. It followed a number of interviews. But in the end, in that particular case, it was issued, that the person was able to satisfy us that it wasn't fraud. But it you know, it was serious enough to take a number of interviews, a number of concerns. Because, you know, people were, a British passport, like any passport, was a valuable document to some people.
Mm-hmm.
There were people who perhaps tried to take advantage, but more often than not, they were people who were renewing a passport or, as you say, were trying to get it for a younger child or something like that.
Were you contacted by any Jamaican officials? Or I know that you left post in 2017, which was shortly before the scandal erupted, but were you... What was the position of the basically Jamaican officials when you were there? Was this ever discussed, or was it?
Those cases, I think, that I mentioned, certainly one of them, the one that appeared in the press, because it appeared in the press, it became very well known. And I remember discussing that with opposite numbers at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Mm.
You know, in passing, and you know, to report on progress, really.
Mm. What do you know about the Jamaican National Identity Card as well? Because I know that there have been a number of efforts to improve the National Identification System, NIDS it's called. Did you have any kind of...
Not really.
Inkling of
I think the only, the only recollection I have about that is that there was a British company who made ID cards, made passports, and so on, and was interested in doing it. In the end, I don't think they won the contract
they
to do it.
No.
But that was the only knowledge I have of that.
Okay. So when the scandal erupted in 2018, where were you?
I was back here. I'd retired from the Foreign Service in September 2017. And, you know, it rang a lot of bells because of those cases I've quoted. And, you know, it did... begin when I read those very good articles in The Guardian at the time, thinking, gosh, this is obviously a really serious issue, which was much more serious than we were aware of at the time.
And as we know, Amelia Gentleman really picked up on
for
a number of years. She was in the background tracing basically what was happening and collating evidence of the impact that this was having on people's lives. Did you have any discussions with former colleagues or any?
No, I can't honestly say I did. Okay. It may have come up in passing whenever I was talking to colleagues in the Foreign Office, but I can't recall, and not in any serious way.
Okay. So I just wanted us then to, we've spoken about trade and commerce and industry. We've talked a little bit about registrations and deportations. We've also talked about the reparations debate and securitisation issues, as well as prisons. Were there any other business interests in the region that that the UK was
less at the time in Jamaica than in Bahamas, but there were energy companies who were helping. Obviously, as in many parts of the world, energy security was an issue, less so than these days perhaps, but it was a key issue, and it probably was in Jamaica too. We had a very small project we helped with on solar energy, very, very small in Jamaica. It was almost just an extended research project. But there were companies who were interested in providing a temporary power generation in Bahamas, for example, when I was there. So, and I suspect that's become more of an issue since I left.
What would you say are the, looking towards the future, are kind of the major issues that you think will and are affecting not just Jamaica but the broader Caribbean region?
Well, energy is going to be a worldwide concern, energy security. I mean, the Caribbean has lots of lovely sunshine, so, you know, solar power ought to be a potential solution to some of those problems. Wind power too, perhaps. Sorry, that's just focusing on energy. But there, I think when the vote on Brexit happened, there were a lot of people, politicians particularly in this country, who talked about, you know, developing trade with the Commonwealth and trade deals with different parts of the Commonwealth. And there was perhaps, I don't know for certain, but I suspect on the Jamaican side, a hope that that might, you know, provide an opportunity for Jamaican agricultural exporters, food exporters, processed food exporters. And potentially it could. There may be prospects, you know. Bringing food and agricultural produce from that part of the world is more expensive than bringing it from Europe. But in the long run, it might provide more opportunities. So there may be better prospects for trade.
What were the conversations you were having around Brexit at the time? And did that take up a big amount of your...
Well, it did. It happened in 2016, the vote.
Yeah.
I think before that, probably our conversations were as they were elsewhere in the world about what might happen and what might not happen. But when we all woke up to the results of the vote in June 2016, the first thing I did was telephone the foreign minister, the Jamaican foreign minister, and I didn't have any instructions from London. But I said to her, you'll have seen this, as we have. We're all waiting to see what precisely this means. But rest assured, it won't make any difference to UK-Jamaica relations in any negative way. And potentially it could help improve relations. But I wasn't speaking to any sort of brief. I was just trying to reassure Jamaican Foreign Minister that that UK-Jamaican relations were at the top of my agenda. And also to enable her, if she was asked by the press, had she spoken to the British government, to be able to say
to
yes.
Say yes.
and that was all, really. But it was... on a personal level, it was quite a shock to see that result that morning. And I think the first thing that happened was I was immediately invited onto a TV show that evening with the French ambassador. The EU ambassador had been invited but didn't want to go. But the French ambassador agreed to go and I went. And we had a discussion about what it means. And I don't think either of us really knew at that stage what it meant, what it would mean. But we were trying to be as reassuring as possible about, you know, relate. We were, you know, all sorts of cliches such as the UK is still part of Europe, even if it's not going to be part of the EU, and so on. So it was quite a difficult time in terms of understanding what it meant and waiting to hear what the government wanted us to say about it.
And did the Brexit resonate strongly with Jamaicans, for example? So I've been asking about the Windrush scandal, for example, and the responses that we've received so far is that most people in the Caribbean, it wasn't on their radar. So the Windrush scandal wasn't something that was really, it was seen as something that was happening in the UK, that was happening overseas, and not really related to, or, you know, that integral to what was going on in the Caribbean. What about Brexit? What was the reaction there?
I think before it happened, probably, as you say, not didn't really impinge on people's lives. But once the vote happened, the newspapers and the media reported events in the UK quite a lot because everyone had family and friends here and, you know, close links with the UK. Mm. Not all of them were positive links, but they always seemed to have an interest in stories about the UK, good or bad. So there was
What were some of the good stories and what was
well,
the bad stories?
You know, there may be, I don't know, there may have been something on the sporting field which Jamaicans were interested in, but there may have been other stories which were, I don't know, the UK, let's say the UK had developed strong links with countries in Europe and turning its back on the Caribbean, that sort of thing was a bad story for Jamaica. So there was a lot of interest, whatever direction it took. So when Brexit happened, yes, there was a lot of interest, but I don't know how deep it went. And it was probably seen as a problem that the UK had and not one for Jamaica. But there may have been people in the business sector who said to themselves, are there opportunities here? Mm. I don't think any of us, myself included at that stage, knew for certain what that would mean, whether there would be real opportunities.
Mm. And just to put some context for our listeners, the Commonwealth Games are starting week as well.
Was it the same week? Gosh, was it? Oh, this you
no,
mean,
this week now.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, while I was there, we had the Glasgow Games and got heavily involved in preparations for that and even ran for a short distance with the baton to hand it over. And, of course, athletics in particular in Jamaica was and is very popular, as we saw at the World Championships, athletic champions this week.
Yes, the sport is a huge.
Huge. And, you know, for the Commonwealth Games, for us as Brit hosts at that time in Glasgow, and I suspect the same is true of Birmingham this week, having Jamaica participate with a strong team was really very important and very welcome. Mm. And at that time, Jamaica had some extremely strong runners. Mm. Usain Bolt was still running. Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, who's still running now, was running then and winning medals. So it was, I didn't mention sport when you were asking me about our activities, but sport was quite a big part of what we did, whether it was helping, Jamaican athletes and Paralympians take part in events at the Commonwealth Games and also at the 2012 Olympics and then afterwards. So I kept those links. You know, sport's always a good way of having friendlier links with a country, but I kept those links at the forefront of our relationship to the extent I could.
Mm. We're going to start wrapping up the interview now, so I wanted to bring that back to the Windrush scandal, really. Mm. Did anybody come to you or speak to you about the Windrush scandal and kind of its... or even your own thoughts about its impact on Britain's reputation overseas? Was there anything that you thought that was basically damaging that came out of that scandal?
Yeah, I did think it was damaging. Do you mean, did anyone come to me after I left?
Either did you have direct conversations with anybody who came to you to talk about the scandal, or what are your personal impressions about the legacy, basically the ongoing impact of what the UK government essentially did?
Well, to answer your first question, no, nobody did come to talk to me, and I didn't go out of my way to talk to anyone. I had thoughts on it, personal thoughts, which I'll come to, but I didn't particularly see, unless anyone was interested, I didn't particularly want to make anything of them. On a personal level, yeah, I thought it was quite terrible what had happened. As I said earlier, even the couple of cases that I had to deal with on a human level were quite shocking. But, you know, in an administrative sense, I think they were very badly done by the people concerned. And once it became clear that, you know, this was a much bigger issue in by 2018, then yeah, I personally felt very shocked by it.
What needs to change?
Well, it's very difficult for individuals to understand what the problem is, whether it was a conscious effort to make life difficult for people. And, you know, we talked earlier about hostile environment on immigration. That, if you like, is a conscious effort to make life difficult for illegal immigrants. But its side effect was to make life difficult for legal immigrants. And I think that's where proper administration is required, and it clearly wasn't there. Some of it may have been, you know, mistakenly absent, may have been accidentally absent. I'm not sure that everything that happened to the people who suffered was done deliberately, but some of it was done because of a lack of proper measures in place. Even something simple like the Home Office destroying people's landing cards, which seems to have happened when they came, you know, after a certain time. I suppose somebody somewhere said, well, we have to get rid of all this old paperwork. And, you know, that's it may be a mistake or an accident, whatever you choose to call it, but it has terrible consequences, as we've seen, for people. And so it was the human aspect that affected me most about it.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to say before we finish the interview?
No, as I say, it's a long time now since I dealt with Jamaica directly and left Jamaica in 2017. But there are one or two elements which obviously stay very, very uppermost in your mind when things like that happen. So it's interesting to talk through.
Okay, thank you so much for your time today.